Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
One quick message before I start the show. You can find all the links and resources for this episode by visiting the show notes on rickyrichards.com. If you enjoy this episode, do consider subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're feeling particularly generous, you can help me to grow the show by leaving a review on iTunes. For anyone who does subscribe, review or share, thank you. I appreciate it. Now let's get into the show. Welcome to Ricky Richards Represents, the show where I talk tips for success with leading figures of creativity and innovation. Hello everyone, thank you for tuning in to another episode of the podcast. Today I'm joined by a very special guest, someone whose work I greatly admire, Mr. Alan Kitching. So hello Alan.
Hello to you all. Yeah.
Before we get into the interview, I'm just going to give you a quick overview of Alan's prolific background. So Alan is one of the world's most foremost practitioners of letterpress, typographic design and printmaking. He is renowned for his expressive use of wood and metal letter forms in creating visuals for commissions and his own limited edition prints. Alan has also had solo shows in London and Barcelona and contributed to various exhibitions, including, this is where I get this horribly wrong pronunciation-wise, Pompidou Centre in Paris, the British Library and Barbican Art Gallery in London. In 1944, Alan was appointed as the Royal Designer for Industry and elected a member... 1944, that would be a different story, right? Royal Designer for Industry and elected member of the Alliance Graphique Internationale. Alan is an honorary fellow of the Royal College of Art and visiting professor at the University of Arts in London. He's conducted his workshops and given talks to industry, art schools and design conventions in the UK, Europe, Australia and South Africa. Previous clients include Borough Market, the British Library, Creative Review, D&AD, Days and Confused, The Guardian, National Theatre. I could go on and on and on. I think I'll save the audience. But basically, you've worked for just about everyone.
Just about.
You've been busy. And how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, on this lovely summer's evening.
Yeah, it is. it's summer's. It's beautiful slash clammy. One or the other. So let's start off easy. I just thought that I would ask you, you know, you're very gifted technically. Why did you decide to dedicate yourself to letterpress printing?
When I left school at age 14... I mean, I wanted to be a poster artist, but the northeast of England, where I came from, Darlington, County Durham, in those days, it was people making steam locomotives, bridges. When we were a kid at school, I mean, we were drummed into us that we are the people who built the Sydney Harbour Bridge. We are the people who put the bridge over the Zambezi at Victoria Falls. You know, it was heavy industrial area I came from.
Yeah.
And so to be a poster artist was a bit an odd thing to choose.
And so was there a poster in particular that was like, you know, that drew your attention?
I remember seeing, it wasn't a poster, but it was an ad in the local paper, the Northern Echo. It was an ad for Freedom from Hunger. and it was a drawing of a starving child, and the ribs were showing through his rib cage. And on the other side, it was ears of corn. It's a metaphor for the ribs, you see,
yep.
And vice versa.
That was Abram Gaimes.
And that was Abram Gaimes. And that was the first thing I kind of recognised, that, you know, there's, in design, there's something, the more going on than what you just think of, you know, drawing. When yep. you were a kid, you're drawing horses, you're drawing cars, you're drawing stuff
there was,
like
there
that.
Was a concept there.
Yeah.
I think his work has, you know, inspired me as well. I actually found one of his 1951, what was it, the British exhibition for, you know, one of his classic pieces.
The Festival of Britain.
Festival of Britain,
you designed
yeah.
the logo for that.
Yeah, and I happened to stumble into it in a second-hand shop, and I was like, bought yeah, that, it's yeah, framed yeah. up in my room, yeah, love yeah. it. So one of your early influences, as well as Abram Gaimes, was actually Jan Tichold, is that how you pronounce it?
Chickold.
Chickold. What was it that drew you to his work?
Well, I saw his work in printing magazines, and I just thought it was so exquisitely done. The black and the white, and the use of the space, and the caps there, and something else there, and it was all just very spatially kind of worked out, and looked exciting. Because the only thing I'd been used to looking at is sort of symmetrical, you know, book title pages and things like that. All the types centred, and it's all in capital letters, and it's all beautifully letter spaced, and it's all like that, you know, traditional stuff. And Chickwell's work was a brand new thing.
So this is one of the things that really amazes me about looking at your early history, is how kind of your attention to detail on over these what many people would consider kind of trivial bits of things, like, you know, a letterhead or something like that, but it was just beautiful, and the amount of effort and everything that went into it. What do you think made you so attentive to details and such small things?
Well, to go back to my start of the question about why I became what I'm doing, it was the poster thing didn't work out, but the nearest thing they could think of, you know, when I was 14, 15, was the printing industry, which was quite a very, you know, astute and a wise thing to suggest, because it dealt with lettering and words and things like that. So they thought that was the nearest thing they could get me to go into. And when I went into that world, I loved it. I just fell in love with all the type and the whole typography thing, you know. It just was a real rich vein of things to work on. And in doing that, it is a very precise, finicky sort of business. And I suppose that's where you've got to pay attention to very fine detail and spacing and how things fit together and things like that. It's kind of ingrained into you from the very start.
So talking about ingraining it into you, am I right in saying that to some degree, your mentor was Anthony C? All of the people that you've worked with, the names are quite difficult.
Anthony Frossow.
Yes, that's correct, yeah. In your book, it mentions that he was quite a strict man, but, you know, for any designs out there, he's kind of a legend in his own right.
Yeah.
If you had to say, what was like one of some of the things that you learned from him?
Sort of integrity, honesty. And being honesty and integrity. Yeah, I think that was what I learned in terms of.
So, how would that manifest itself as a creatively?
Well, Anthony was very strict in his work. He would only use certain sizes of type. He would only use black and white, really, maybe a bit of red. It was very mathematical. And I learned that from Anthony. Mathematics was important to the business of design.
And how was he able to justify, you know, these things to clients?
Oh, he didn't have any clients, I don't think.
Right.
Well, he might have had, but he didn't. I don't know, he kept them for long. But he's mainly a great teacher, Anthony, a theorist. He didn't produce much work in his time, but he had an incredible influence on people. Because he was a very charismatic person. I mean, no, the Mighty Pentagram today, Alan Fletcher was sadly no longer with us, but Alan Fletcher, one of the England's great designers, he was taught by Anthony, as was Colin Forbes. And Derek Birdsall, you know, started Omnific. They were all, and Ken Garland, you know, the greats of British graphic design in the 50s and 60s. They were all taught by Anthony.
It's funny, I was just reading The Art of Looking Sideways just yesterday.
Yeah, right, yeah, exactly. But you wouldn't think so sometimes by looking at Fletcher's work.
Yeah.
But underpinning it, all those guys, there was this sort of integrity of purpose, an honest approach to things.
You feel that was fostered by him?
I think it was, actually. Yeah. He was very strict and very severe, and yet the man himself wasn't. He was a bit of a shambles, but his thinking was very concise.
What was a design education actually like back then, and as a teacher yourself, how do you feel it's changed?
Well, this was the days before the BA courses started. Just was on the brink, really, because I met Anthony in 64, so about 64, 65, the BA courses came in. And I think, well, I was at the Watford College of Technology, the School of Art, where Anthony, I met him, where he came. He became a senior lecturer. And in those days, there was all these smaller art schools around the place. And Watford was a very good one, because it was near London. It was 50 minutes out of Euston. So it attracted some of the best designers who were working in London at the time. And in those days, it isn't like it is now. There was like maybe half a dozen really good designers, of some which I've already mentioned. And they all kind of came up to Watford to teach a day a week. So the teaching was done through professional designers rather than people who did it as a...
like a career, like a just career a job. Seasoned.
Yeah, which... and that's what kept it very lively and active, because you just, they weren't teaching, they were just telling you what they did and how they did it.
So do you think that that's what's missing from today's education, the ability for top flight designers to go in?
I think it does, yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose they still do, but the whole structure's different now. It was very more relaxed. It was up to the head of department who he got, and now he organises his own school and course, where now it's a bigger thing. And
so do you still go to the Royal College of Art now and then?
No. I left there in 2006.
Right. So you have kind of one of the biggest collections of letterpress typography. And as a result, I guess to some degree, you've got a little bit of a monopoly over the production method. Was that a conscious thing, or is that kind of just happened quite organically?
It just happened, but at the same time, when I went in, my workshop was in Clerkenwell, when Clerkenwell wasn't like it is now. It was a desert. There was nobody went there. It was completely, you know. But the workshop was fantastic, and I was there like 16 years. But in the beginning, I had to work out what to do with all this stuff. So the first couple of years, we were experimenting with types and colour and paper, and I was discovering what paper was. Until you start to use paper like that and print on it yourself and look at the surface and look at the weights and the colours, you don't really understand paper until you've started to work with it, really. And so in those first 2 years, I was really finding out for myself and experimenting with colour. I had these blocks, big poster blocks and type and things. And then I started to slowly get commissions.
So I wanted to ask you just a couple of questions regarding some of the processing terminology and stuff. So what's the difference between hot and cold letter setting? Hanging indentations I'm familiar with, but I just thought I'd ask it for the sake of the audience. And Francesco rules and folding classes.
What?
None of these?
Hot metal comes from...
I'm glad you said that as well, because that's the way I feel.
Hot metal is the metal cast from, you know, molten metal.
Right.
Monotype. They had the monopoly on it. And beautifully done. It was beautifully cast, like, very, very accurate. And that's where type was cast and set. Cold typesetting, as it was called, was really, I think, it was either photographically done, and then letraset. So wow. There's no metal involved. It was all pre, cut and...
Right. You prefer the word founts, which is the original word for fonts. Mm. And I thought I'd ask why you prefer that terminology. And also, I hear that you prefer red and black inks over others, and I thought I'd ask why that is as well.
The fonts is, well, again, back to my beginning. It was spelled F-O-U-N-T, yes, font, F-O-U-N-T, not F-O-N-T. And I just, I just have it. I just...
Yeah, yeah. You just like to keep it...
I always write it like that.
Yeah. And the black and...
Say again.
And black and red inks?
Well, the tradition was that, as I said earlier, printing was always done in black ink. Paper was white, the ink was black. And that was the standard for everything. And if you wanted to do a little bit of decoration, you use red, which was a very nice contrast to it. And that survived for years and years and years, you know. The second colour was always red.
So, but when you work with different clients nowadays, obviously they own brand colours and all the rest of it.
I don't bother, but the things I do myself, the prints I make myself, I've experimented with colour in all sorts of directions. I mean, I mixed all the colours myself.
But you still prefer the black, white and red as a three no, most striking?
No, I don't. I keep away from it now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Oh, really? there must have been times when kind of people encouraged you to, work on other things or say, why don't you try other stuff or whatever. What's made you stay so strong to the letterpress?
Well, it's a unique printing process. And the image you get from it is unique. I mean, people can copy it on a computer, but some people don't want to do that. They want the real thing, so I'm pleased they asked me. And it's getting more, I think, for me, more akin to painting and fine art than graphic design. Even though my background is in graphics, one is more and more influenced by painters and galleries, what one sees around.
It's interesting that you say you see it more as art, because when I look at the work, and you in your book you talk about around the time kind of computers coming out, grunge style started to emerge because of the different techniques that you could use. I see the stuff that you do as kind of reminiscent of Bauhaus and Swiss design. What did you think when all these new styles started to emerge that were completely vastly different and creatively wild? Were you anti them or...?
Well, I came from that background of the Bauhaus and the Swiss-German school of design, if you like. But when I started printing myself, I wanted to try and take it somewhere else. So I said I would look at people like... when I was at Watford, I got a very broad education in the arts. And one of the people that struck in my mind was Paul Klee, a great colourist and wonderful constructions of his paintings he made somehow. Juxtapositions of line and colour. So I've always got people like him in the back of my mind. And then I discovered Monet and Matisse. And these are the people I've got on my wall in my studio to keep looking at.
When you started your apprenticeship as a printer, your father actually gave you a Penguin book, 500 Years of Printing,
yes,
as a gift. And yeah, I thought I would ask, what books should people kind of... what books would you recommend people check out, or especially for aspiring kind of printmakers, are there any in particular?
Oh, dear.
No.
I can't think of any.
Okay. Well, how about... if you send me some links afterwards and we can link them up in the show notes.
Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, anyone that's listening, check it out on the website.
Yeah, I can't think top man. I can't think of, you know.
Well, I've actually got something at the end of this list of questions that might spark some inspiration. Mm. So there's a sense that once you know how to set type, that there's like not much to it, and I don't mean that disrespectfully. And I know there's people like Anthony Burrell who've become quite well known, and he developed his style whilst attending your workshops. What do you think about the success of people like Anthony? And, you know, without criticising him, for example, do people lack the appreciation for the details or something with a new way of kind of mass producing these things?
No, I think Anthony was one of my students at the college, and he's a very charming guy, you know, and his work's fantastic. He's a lovely man. And he's one of the people who picked it up. But a lot of the students who came through me at the college, you know, they're all lovely people, and some of them have done very well. And they're all intelligent, talented people, and they've used what they've got, you know, in front of them, so to speak. And I think Anthony's a good example, yeah.
And somebody else who you could consider your apprentice, so Kelvin Smith.
Yeah.
He also runs out of your studio in Kennington, is that correct?
No, he's got his own shop near me.
Oh, okay. But why did you decide that he was the person that you wanted to kind of take under your wing of all the people?
Well, I didn't.
Right.
He just left college. He knocked on my door when I was in Clerkenwell. I went three or four times and I didn't really have a lot of work. And he was persistent, so in the end I said, yes, come in. And good boy, and... stayed like 4 years with me, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So you've worked with some absolute legends, people like Hans-Jörg Meyer.
Hans-Jörg Meyer.
Meyer, there you go. Dieter Rott.
Yeah.
Alan Fletcher, yeah. Colin Forbes. And are there any commonalities between these people, things that, you know, you identified that made them who they were?
Well, as I said earlier, it was Frossau was the catalyst. But Hans-Jörg came through he brought the concrete poetry movement into Britain, and gave it its voice, and he printed books and did things like that. And he was Hans-Jörg's still around. He's still working. He's about my age, I think. And he had his own sort of severe way of working, very rigid, very black and white, only used for Tudor typeface. You know, no punctuation.
Oh, wow.
It's very...
interesting.
Oh, yeah.
So he's got his own very rigid philosophy.
He was a different take from Anthony, you know, but the same. They had the same kind of approach, but quite different.
I'm going to change the subject a little bit. This is like a massive deviation, but not to bring up something which is particularly sad, you know, that's going to bring up anything bad. But obviously, your partner sadly passed away in 2010.
Yeah.
And I thought it was important to bring up because, you know, other people go through similar experiences. And as a creative, as someone who's often very dedicated to what you do, it's nice to have someone who wholeheartedly supports you in your creative endeavours.
Well, she certainly did, yeah. Celia Stothard, yeah. We got married in the end.
So I just wondered if there was, you know, you produced a book for her, didn't you? And I thought maybe you could talk about her a little bit.
I meant to bring it, actually. I forgot to bring it. I should have wrote it. Celia was a very talented woman. She was a singer, performer, and a very good designer. And she'd... And teacher, she taught at the Croydon College of Art for a long time. When it was a good college, almost like now. And we met, and you know, we hit it off, and she knew what I did, and she liked all that dedication to a certain approach to work, and you know, we bought this big collection together. You know, it took us like 2 years to shift it, and she was wholeheartedly behind that. She loved the type. She made the system to keep tabs on it and the catalogues and things. And hugely supportive. And we worked together on certain projects, and sometimes she would be a very good critic when we did work together, or sometimes I did on my own. She would always look at it, or I'd ask her opinion, or just comments and so on, and it was always very, very intelligent, sound comments she would make.
So do you think you become, you know, who you are today without her support?
I'm trying to think, because yes, I think, I don't know, you know, I met her 20 years ago.
Yeah. There's something about books that kind of long after that we're gone, that they live on and tell the stories of our lives. And the book that you've created, it documents your life and work up to date. And, you know, for anyone that's within the creative industries, you'll be familiar with your work. Obviously, your legacy is certainly cemented. But do you feel like your work is done, and what do you intend to focus on moving forward?
Well, the first thing to say that the book was actually, it's got my work in it, but it was created by John Walters.
Yeah.
Who was the editor of I Magazine. He was a fantastic writer. I mean, because Celia started the book off about 12 years ago. And then it went away. And then Lawrence King, the publisher, he came under the scene, that got interested in it for some reason, I can't remember now. But when it was kind of mooted that they would do the book, I said, well, look, I said, you know, I need someone to write it, because I can't. And I asked John if he would, and he said he would, and he did a fantastic job. So he's the author of the book. His name's on the title page. And he is the editor of I Magazine, and Simon Esterson, who is the art director of I asked Simon if he would design the book. So he was the art director on the book, on the whole thing. So that between the two of them, they did the book. And there was a third person who was my assistant then, who went to work for Simon, who's called John Keelty. And he did the day-to-day typography and the work on. So there's three of them really worked on the book, I'm very grateful to the trio.
And so, just out of interest, like, how has a book impacted your life? Has it done anything for you? I know you appeared on Jonathan Ross Show. You informed me of prior. Is that something we can YouTube?
You could do if you want. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wicked! I'll pull that up. Basically, a lot of people produce books in order to establish themselves as a figurehead in a certain area. I mean, I believe that this book's obviously come about a lot more organically than that.
It does, yeah.
But have you seen a rise in profile as a result?
No, I don't think so.
No?
Not that I can tell, yeah. No. Well, I think what a book does like that for you is that it allows you to look back at all your work and reassess it a bit. See where you went wrong, where you went right, you know.
Do you look at stuff and go, oh?
Sometimes, but you also forget what you've done sometimes. You think, well, that was, That's an idea which I haven't pursued lately, you know. I picked that one up again.
Yeah, it keeps you going. So before I ask the final question, where can people get hold of you? What are you working on at the moment? And maybe if you wanted to kind of plug your workshops and all that kind of stuff.
No, I don't do any workshops anymore, but I think Calvin's going to start doing them again. And I might do them in conjunction with him. I'm just I'm working on various projects for one or two commissions. And in between these commissions, I work on projects like when a certain anniversary comes up. Like I did a print about the Battle of Agincourt and 100 years since Dylan Thomas had died. Was it last year, year before? I did a big piece on his Under Milk Wood radio play. And this year I'm working on something about the Russian Revolution. 100 years since it happened in October.
Is kind of part of your philosophy just, well, and it doesn't necessarily need to be philosophy, but do you just pursue your interests?
Yes, I think if I can make a decent print out of it, it might be interesting in the end.
So just for the people listening, Alan's actually kindly signed his book and I'm going to be giving that away to a listener of the show. So if people, in order to actually be in with a chance of having that, if you could head over to the website, sign up to my mailing list and I'll be putting it out for the listeners there. Thank you very much for doing that. And if, as a final question, if you could just give what you would consider to be the one piece of advice that would help people live a better and more meaningful life, whether that be creatively, I think that's a nice way to end.
Well, I can do it by quoting Anthony Burrell. Work hard, be nice to people.
Work hard, be nice to people. Yeah, I like it. It's good. All right, it was absolutely lovely to meet you. I really appreciate you sharing your background and hope people who have tuned in have enjoyed it. And yeah, it was lovely to meet you.
Okay, Ricky, thank you very much. So have I. Thank you.
Bye, everyone. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe and share. I'd also like to invite you to an ongoing project called the Move Me Mailing List. If you enjoyed the show, I'm confident you'll enjoy this newsletter. It contains links to all the great content I've uncovered each month, along with insights of any interesting opportunities I've discovered. You can subscribe to this by visiting my website at rickyrichards.com. A special thanks to Frankie Byrne and James Utting. They're the tech heads that make this show possible. The intro music was composed by Dom Stores Fox, and thanks again to Rhys Chapman for introing me to Lou and Lizette, the wonderful folks at Factory Studios in London, where this show is recorded. Finally, wherever you are in the world, I hope you have a great day and keep creating. Until next time, bye for now.